Entrepreneur Architect Podcast, Episode 18. Welcome to this episode of the Entrepreneur Architect Podcast. My name is Mark R. LePage, and this is the podcast dedicated to a successful life as a small firm architect. My goal is to inspire you to build a better business so that you may pursue your purpose with passion and finally live the life of your dreams. David Zock is a futurist. I don't know about you, but before meeting David at AIAS Forum in Chicago, I thought futurism was the creation of science fiction writers. But in fact, David Zock is a professional futurist. David is a full-time speaker and has given more than 1,500 presentations over the past 27 years. He was a member of the board of directors for AIA National and has a personal passion for the future of architecture. This is an action-packed episode of the Entrepreneur Architect Podcast. We talk about so much from the future trends in architecture to how to get started as a public speaker. David recites quotes, gives great advice, and recommends a bunch of videos, books, and websites, so you are going to want to get the show notes for this one. Go to entrearchitect.com/episode18, and everything is going to be there waiting for you. I really enjoyed speaking with David, and I really hope you enjoy it too. I think this one's going to get you thinking. So here we go. Here's the interview. David Zock, welcome to the Entrepreneur Architect Podcast.
Hi, Mark.
Hi, it's great to have you here. I like to start off my interviews with talking with our guests about their background, to get into their origin story a little bit. So, So tell us, how is a futurist born?
Well, I come from a small farm town where you wouldn't perhaps expect a futurist to come from, but I had a course in high school called The Future. And it was all about reading science fiction and extrapolating out what are the implications of the various technologies and choices we have. Went to college to become a lawyer, but then I did a very smart thing. I got a job in the law library, and I found what lawyers do for a living and realized I would have been a terrible one. There is a magazine called The Futurist that you can find at any Barnes & Noble. And there was an ad in there for earn a master's degree in studies of the future at the University of Houston. Well, that was quite intriguing, and you know, I've always read science fiction. So I went down to Houston, got the degree, and then came back to Wisconsin and ended up in Milwaukee working at Johns Controls as my first job. And while there, I started getting involved in lots of community projects, and people kept asking me to do a speech about the future. And I think I probably did 10 or 15 of them, and somebody, without warning, gave me a $40 honorarium. So basically, as a futurist, I am a professional speaker. And I work with all sorts of organizations, from the Critical Care Nurses Association to the Adhesive Tape Council, and just talking to these various organizations about future trends as well as traditions. Because to my mind, the future isn't just about change. It's about holding on to the things that are worth saving.
Yeah, I love that. So as a futurist, you're looking into the past as well.
Yes. And you know, it's a lot easier to study the past than it is the future.
Yeah, yeah. So futurism, it's a career. It's something that someone can choose to be and work their way to become a futurist.
Sure.
Interesting.
There's not exactly a sort of a set instruction manual. Here's how to be a futurist. And we have all sorts of them, you know, coming from all different directions. There's actually even Cindy Freeman is an architect in Kansas City who has also has a degree from the University of Houston.
Very interesting. You know, I've read about futurists, and in architecture school, you study some architects that were futurist architects.
Mm-hmm.
I never realized that it was actually a career path, that it's something that someone set out to become and follow, you know, went to school for it and everything. It was very interesting to learn that when we met.
It's a fairly new field, and I think the Houston program, which is probably the tops, I think there may be five programs overall, but I think that was started in 1974.
Yeah, interesting. We met at in Chicago at the AIAS Forum, which is the American Institute of Architecture Students National Convention, where I was scheduled to speak, and you were there, and you spoke as well. You have spoken there before.
Yes.
And we met, and we started getting got talking a little bit, and you were speaking about the future of architecture. Mm-hmm. So tell me. Actually, a couple of things. First, how did you get involved in architecture? If you're not you didn't study to be an architect.
No,
you're not an architect.
No,
but there's clearly an interest in architecture. And then, let's talk about a little bit about what you think the future of architecture holds for us all, both short term and long term.
Okay. Well, I'm one of those rare people who never really ever wanted to be an architect, but. When I was growing up, when I was in grade school, my father hired an architect to design our home. And his name was Edmund Howe, and he had been a student of Frank Lloyd Wright. So he was at the fellowship. So from 7 years old on, I knew who Frank Lloyd Wright was, and I also knew what an architect was. And I was really intrigued just because that architect really involved my father, I mean, let him interfere with the plans. And it was just a fascinating thing to watch. Architects are futurists. And when you think about the fact that if you build something, it may outlast you, it may outlive you, that gives you sort of legitimate claim to say you're a futurist because you're thinking about what else happens with this building. And I think that's fascinating. I got hired a couple times to speak at some AIA state conventions in Wisconsin here, and then even moderated the whole convention 1 year. And then I think it was like in 2001 or 2000, I was kind of moderating their retreat, the board retreat, and they decided they wanted to have a non-architect on the board. But then they couldn't figure out who. So I kind of leaned in and said, well, what about me? And they all kind of laughed, and then I got on the board. So I was on that board for 2 years. And then because I've spoken at so many AIA components around the country, in 2010, I was nominated and elected to the AIA National Board as one of their public directors. They always have two non-architects on the board, and we have the sort of the glorious job of occasionally interrupting conversations and pointing out things that nobody was thinking about, which is not sort of a condition of architects. It's any occupation gets insular, looks inward, and it's, I think any occupation should have an outside point of view to help them see or to think into other boxes, as it were.
Yeah, architects, I think, are guilty of that much more than any other profession. We do sort of live within our own world, which is one of the reasons I do what I do, in order to try to get people to look beyond their small, very focused world that we often live in. So let's talk about the future of architecture. Where do you see architecture, say, in 5 years from now, and then, which is, you know, relatively soon, although in 5 years in in internet time is a whole lot of, you know, a whole lot of time.
It is.
And then something more like 20 years. Where were you going? Where do you see it being in 20 years?
All right. Let me preface that and almost back up the conversation just a little bit, because you talk about how architects may be more insulated than others.
Right.
Well, one of my favorite terms applied to an architect is citizen architect, and I think that it is misinterpreted because quite often we think it's an architect who runs for public office. No. And a citizen architect is an architect who is involved in citizenship. And that means that you doing this blog and speaking about entrepreneurism, it makes you a citizen architect. And one of the things in terms of thinking about the future, architects must reclaim that notion of citizenship, because they, in some ways, their training, the way they are taught to think and solve problems, means that they are probably better positioned to be full citizens than almost any other occupation. And I have jokingly said, architects do not have an excuse for being boring, because they are some of the most interesting people I know. But I think the occupation sometimes makes them, forces them to keep looking inward and be obsessed about the details, when in fact they also need to obsess about the big picture. There is a big, big fear that I have that the future of architecture will be boring, because there is so much attention to sort of the technical. And you see so many buildings. I've shared with you before, there's this marvelous tweet from a filmmaker in Chicago, Melissa Pierce, and the tweet was, so many new buildings look cold and unromantic, boxy without curves. I'm starting to believe the architects had mothers that never loved them." And it's just that we have lost the artistic aspect, and that is unforgivable. It is understandable, because the bottom line gets so overwhelming
Right.
with, I think, a lot of projects. And part of the problem is that because we're so busy, we don't have time to look up from the screen. But architects need to have an ability to be much better defenders of what good design is. And one of the fascinating things that's coming into this arena is the whole notion of 3D printing, which I think it just blows off the doors, literally and figuratively, of what we can do. And we will no longer be as constrained by these specific measurements, for this window and that wall segment. So many buildings I see are just a variation on something else. Oh, we'll cantilever it this way, or we'll have this sized, panel as opposed to that size panel. Well, that when modernism in architecture, came in, or whatever term you want to use for it, where they got rid of detail, that was a sad day, and I think it has made for a sad era, where we cannot have play and whimsy in our designs.
Yeah, I think that the reality of the budget is often the culprit. That when we start out as young architects, we all have very big dreams of
Oh, yes.
being that
Oh,
architect
yes.
that will change the world and will create amazing, interesting architecture. And then over the years of having those battles with clients and engineers and developers and contractors, you start to give in,
Of course.
and those interesting pieces of architecture in development get crushed before they ever even are introduced to the client. It takes a very brave architect to push against the person who's paying you to show them that there's a better way, that and even if it's a less expensive way, clients are very often afraid of things that they're not accustomed to.
Sure.
And especially when they're developers, where they're trying to make money, and they know that this project will make money if it's designed this way. And architects may know a better way and may make them more money, but they're often not willing to take that risk. And so I think that's much of the problem you're describing of the big boxes, that often that's what happens, is the architects get tired of fighting the battle.
Yes. Yeah, and it's certainly unfortunate. Part of it really does come down to, I've used the term, we need an apologetics of design, and the term obviously comes from, theology, but it can be applied to things you believe in. And we don't know how to argue anymore, and we're all so nice. Well, maybe we need to be more articulate and more aggressively assertive about why something is good design. We give up these arguments too easily.
Yeah, and I think there's also an opportunity for architects to start designing and developing their own work, and which I think is a dream of many architects, to become architect developers, where they can do it the way they know it can be done, and create examples and models to show clients and developers of, look, this is a way that it can be done. We can make a lot of money doing it this way. So then now follow me, hire me, and we'll do this for you as well.
A marvelous quote that I found from, and I'm not exactly sure how to pronounce his name, Alain de Botton. He's a philosopher, I believe, out of England. He said, "The creation of beauty, once viewed as the central task of the architect, has quietly evaporated from serious professional discussion and retreated to a confused private imperative." Ouch.
Yeah. Yeah. Ouch. So what about 20 years? What about like long term from now? Where do you see architecture going?
Well, a lot of it depends upon where we are, you know, where we go over the next 5 years.
Right.
But as much as I sometimes have this sort of gloomy outlook, ultimately I am an optimist, and ultimately I have a great sense of hope. And I think that things like 3D printing and crowdsourcing, crowdfunding, it may lead to not only a manufacturing renaissance in this country and everywhere, but also to some sort of renaissance within design. And you may see just much more imaginative ways we will build. And I've been fascinated with this whole notion of, could we print houses?
Yeah.
Well, you know, when you look at the precision, the microscopic precision by which we can print things, and then you pull into that even things like nanotechnology, which are at the molecular level of mechanics, it's not unimaginable that we would have the technology to print a house, print while, you know, in the same time, print the walls, print the wires, print the circuits, print the doors, print the windows, the latches, all of the above. And, you know, it just, one of the things I'm really liking is amongst young architects that I've met, a number of them, they're sort of launching out on their own. Right. And, you know, they when you see the word lab attached to somebody's firm, you right. know, they're just kind of messing around. And there is this marvelous notion of basic research is what I'm doing when I don't know what I'm doing. Well, you know, we've got so many interesting tools that are still in their infancy. And so I want people to take more time and just play and to experiment. And, you know, I've jokingly, you heard it in my talk for AIS, that sometimes some of the best innovation happens when someone says, here, hold my beer and watch this.
Right.
You know, to just not exactly know what the outcome is, but to imagine it and then to try and realize it.
Right. And embrace failure.
Yes.
To go beyond what you think is possible and not be afraid to fail.
And the freedom to fail, I believe, is vastly more important than the freedom to succeed.
Yeah.
Because when we have the freedom to succeed, it quite often means that the pathways have already been cleared out. And as long as you stay on the path, you can succeed.
Yeah.
But what if you have an idea that doesn't fit in that path? You know, and so the ability to try something, fail, and then look at yourself, look at the situation while you're lying on the ground and go, oh, well, that hurt, yeah. and then not do that again. You know, that's a very critical thing. But here's a big issue. We have become so afraid of failure because we have gotten so comfortable in our affluence that we are afraid to fail soon, small, and near. And therefore, then, you know, we don't want anything to fail big and far away, which is obviously, that's the goal. You don't want big failures. But if we are, it will ultimately fail big if we don't learn to respond to small failures.
Yeah, I think the path to that freedom you're describing is entrepreneurism.
Mm-hmm. It is.
When small firm architects and sole proprietors embrace entrepreneurism and understand that they're running businesses and build thriving, profitable businesses, then they'll have the freedom to take those risks and to mm-hmm. and to explore the opportunities that are out there, both in architecture and in the way we present ourselves as architects. Our business models and our delivery methods can then we can take risks and explore and try different ways of doing things because we have strong, healthy businesses that are running well.
Sure. And Mark, let me ask you this. Do you find that people really understand the term entrepreneur?
I think they're coming around to it.
Okay.
That's my mission.
Yeah, good. Keep going.
to get architects to break out of the traditional box that they're in and explore the opportunities that are out there and take the risk and build strong businesses, because that's a bit, you know, the strong business is only a little piece of entrepreneurism.
Right. And Mark, there's this marvelous line from Earl Nightingale, who was one of the original motivational speakers.
Yes.
And he said, the biggest mistake you'll ever make in your life is to believe that you work for somebody else.
Yeah.
Which means, to my mind, is that everybody has to be an entrepreneur at some point. And I believe the sort of the origin of the word entrepreneur, French, is to undertake something. Well, we all undertake things. And it, you know, we get so comfortable. We get, you know, we retire in place. And we just, you know, it's this slow, gradual decline into obscurity, into retirement. You know, we're all sort of sitting in these barco loungers when we should be up on our feet and, you know, being a lot more active. And you and I, you know, we sort of bonded, was, you know, down at the forum, and both of us had this message to the students that they all have to be entrepreneurs, regardless of whether they're going to work for a big firm or for their own firm. And I would even extend it, because we all know there's a whole bunch of people that will study to become architects and then not become architects.
Right, and that's okay.
Yes, it is not only okay, I think it's actually a really good thing, because we need to understand the thinking that these people have can be applied to any type of other occupation. And Maya Small is this architect out of Providence, has this website, a Tumblr list called Architects of Other Things.
Yeah.
And it's this marvelous list of people who studied architecture and then went on and took that knowledge, took that training, and became successful with it elsewhere.
Right. I mean, another one of the things that I'm trying to send the message out to architects is to give them permission to let go of the traditional architecture, because I think so many of them work so hard. We all work so hard. It takes over 10 years to become a licensed architect.
Mm-hmm.
We start very young. We often start with an idea planted in our minds by our parents, and so there's that whole, you know, not wanting to disappoint our parents. And by the time you get to become an architect, very often when you get there, it's not what you expected, or you discover that, you know, you're better at something else, and there's another passion that's deep inside that you just want to go do it, but you're an architect, so you need to stay being an architect. And what I want to let architects know, and I constantly pound into this podcast and in the things I write about, is it's okay to not be a traditional architect. You will always be an architect. Once you become an architect, you are an architect. You don't have to design buildings to be an architect.
Good.
Once you reach that place in your career, you can now go and do whatever you want. You can take the things that you've learned as an architect and apply them to other things in society and solve problems for other people and solve massive global problems because you have a different way of thinking. And that's something that I think is the future as well. So what are your thoughts on that?
Well, we had discussed this book, What Color's Your Parachute, by, what's the guy's name? Dick Bowles. And I had a course in graduate school called Life Work Planning. And the essence of that was we learned to identify what were our skills, both our strong, you know, our key peak skills, as well as, you know, sort of the accessory skills that go with that. And then how to take and repackage those, you know, sort of assemble those and realize this occupation uses this set and that occupation uses that set. But we were also then, we were helped to understand how do we then articulate what those skills are. And so when we think about the term architect, we think of a singular skill. Right. But in fact, it's this collection of skills. And I think we fail all occupations by making people think that they're singular when in fact they are these clusters. And another thing that this younger generation is always described as being collaborative. Well, but it's oftentimes treated more as a noun than a verb. Well, it has to be an active verb, and it means that if they can identify what their component skills are, then they can also help them recognize what their skill gaps are, and that's where collaboration comes in. But it means that if we can help people better understand what's the full set of skills that go with architecture, then it means that they can be much more transferable and new skills added in to take them into different directions.
Yeah, and in that same theme with collaboration, architects among themselves should be collaborating as well. And sharing and being open and transparent with one another about what they're doing and how they're doing it. And as we share our information with one another, how we build the business models that work and how we're charging and the fee structures that we're working with, everything will start to improve and we'll be able to build a stronger, healthier profession, piece by piece.
Mm-hmm. Well, and as you know, also, I created this presentation on presentation skills for architects because I would go around to these schools and find that they didn't, they're presenting their plans during a crit, but quite often the presentation skills were so bad, and it's not taught. I met a woman that ran the Phoenix AIS forum, Ada Rose Mancusi. She loves presenting. And she said, that's what I want to do for a firm. And the confidence that she gained, and she was Miss Seattle, but the confidence she gained in being able to present was a key skill that she brought along. Well, and if we can identify within this singular category, what are the component skills, and then find who is best, who has a right calling for that. I really wonder, I really struggle with the whole idea of not specializing. It's probably too deep for us to get into, but I think the field has gotten so big, I don't know how you can't start to narrow down.
Yeah. Well, I'll invite you back and we'll talk about specialization because we could definitely do an entire podcast episode on that alone.
And someone would probably be better at it than me, yeah.
No, I don't know about that.
Yeah.
Well, let's get into public speaking a little bit.
All right.
Because you're probably the most experienced person I know with public speaking. If an architect had a message, mm-hmm, and they wanted to get it out into the public, and they think that public speaking may be the best way to do that, do you have any first steps that they should take to start that journey?
Sure. There are lots of resources. I don't care what community you live in. There are lots of resources for learning how to be a better presenter. You have Toastmasters, you have the various chapters in the larger cities of the National Speakers Association. Toastmasters teaches you how to present. National Speakers Association teaches you the business of professional speaking and basically how to manage bookings, things like that. A couple of marvelous resources out there are some books. Gar Reynolds wrote a book called Presentation Zen. That, to me, is one of the Bibles. He has such an elegant way of presenting data in slide decks. Nancy Duarte wrote a book called Slideology. She's got another book out, and I think Gar Reynolds does as well. And then there's also, I don't know the author, but there's a couple of books you can get on for the Kindle from Amazon that are how to give a TED talk and how to make TED talk slides. And they're fairly, they're like $2.99 each of these. And what's nice is they're sort of interactive. If you watch them on an iPad, you can be reading what he's saying about making slides, but then he'll have examples where you can click and then you can go watch an example of a TED talk using this particular aspect of that. There's this marvelous notion that life or success leaves clues, and you don't have to invent anything on your own. So you can search and look for, all right, so what's the best way to do slides, or what's the best way to learn how to speak, and the internet provides it for you. I've done 1,500 talks in my professional career, and even with all of that, I am still pushing myself to learn and adjust. I am in the process right now of completely redesigning my slide deck. And partly it's just to keep that notion from Stephen Covey of, you know, sharpening the saw.
Yeah.
And you force yourself to look at things carefully. But, you know, also understand that there are organizations out there that are always looking for somebody to do a presentation. You know, everything from Rotary to Kiwanis to public schools. And it's okay to make mistakes and not be a good presenter, because let me tell you, my early speeches were not that good. But what you do is you just keep putting yourself out there, and you make mistakes and you pick yourself up and you try again. And you know, I don't know of anybody doing a professional speech that died from it. You know, it's okay to try and see what you can do.
So what if you did all that and you learned the skills and you know what you needed to do, and maybe you spoke at a few local events, how do you get noticed to start of get that ball rolling, to get some momentum? How do you get noticed by the events that are looking for you?
I would say that part of it is by writing and having a website where you are putting content on there, but then also making it known that you have these speeches. One of the little tricks that I have is I also have what are called either send-aheads or leave-behinds. And I have these nice little cards that have content. And sort of, you know, it's free content. So I have one that's on how to tell the difference between what's a fad, a trend, and a principle. And they're nicely designed, and I give those out. And so people keep them.
Yeah.
And people, you know, in my entire career, I've been speaking full time for 27 years. I've never marketed. It's all been word of mouth. And, you know, I've based my business on name recognition and goodwill attached to the name. So, you know, it means volunteering. And if you're involved in something as a citizen architect and there needs to be a presentation or something organized, you step up. And, you know, you say, I can do that. I will do that if you let me.
Yeah. Yeah. And another key is to be very good at what you do, which is what you are.
Well, but it's practice.
Yeah, and, exactly.
You know, and there's a funny thing that, you know, when I'm doing the presentation skills talk, you know, I have this slide entitled The 4%. There are 4% in every audience that comes there just to hate you. And so, you know, it's one of these bizarre things in your career that, you know, you will always find people in your audience who think you totally sucked. And you can't let that stop you, you know, because, well, maybe they're having a bad day or maybe you actually did suck. And then you go back and you figure out, right, what did I do wrong?
Yeah.
Oh. You just keep on having to see what else is out there. And part of it is the ability to tell stories, to craft images. And think about this. A building is a story, you know, not simply stories, but there is a story to tell. And so learning what storytelling is a marvelous craft.
Yeah, I think whether you're going to speak or not, I think storytelling, the skill of storytelling is a very important. We actually had a podcast about that early on, about architects and storytelling. I think it's really, really important. So I think our time is getting close to the end, and I want to ask you one last question.
Okay.
What do you think the one trend is that small firm architects, not you know, architecture in general, but small firm architects, what do you think the one trend is that small firm architects should be paying attention to in order to succeed in the future?
That trend would be that almost any resource you want can be found on the internet. From business plans to networking, you know, the crowdsourcing, you know, like Indiegogo or Kickstarter, that the tools that are available to the big organizations are increasingly becoming available to the small firms. And so you can leverage the resources out there to compete head to head with, you know, other firms or other big firms, but you have to know how to do that, the ability to navigate and focus your attention. It's said that the most valuable resource in the economy today is your attention. So you have to protect it, and you have to learn how to direct it and focus in. The ability to focus is your greatest ability.
Yeah, I was listening to a podcast the other day, and I'm not sure which it was, but the two words they were using was focus and finish.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
So I guess that's what we're doing now, huh?
Yeah. Well, no, focus. that wasn't the intent of that. But focusing is very important. But finishing is also very important because you can start lots of things and focus on many things and never finish them and never really get anywhere because you never really finish.
Well, you know, the internet offers you access to everything, and we're curious. You know, and architects, like anybody else, but more so, are curious people. It's really tough to focus these days.
Yeah.
You know that.
We've spoken about many resources here. You've been very gracious in sharing lots of information. I'll make sure that I link to everything that you talked about today, the books and the videos and everything else that you talked about on the show notes. So anybody who's listening can go to entrearchitect.com and find this podcast and download whatever we're talking about here today.
Okay.
So, David, thank you very much for being with me today.
I appreciate
your time. I look forward to more conversations in the future, and for bumping into you while I do some speaking myself.
That would be great. All right, thanks, Mark.
All right. Thank you, David. Have a great day. So my question to you is, what do you think the future of architecture looks like? Go to entrearchitect.com/episode18 and share your thoughts on my chat with David. Where do you think the profession of architecture will be in 5 years from now? How about 20 years? I'd love to know what you think. I love doing this podcast. I meet so many interesting people and learn so many new things. And I hope you're enjoying it too. If you're interested in getting deeper into learning about business success in architecture, and you want to connect and engage with enthusiastic, like-minded entrepreneur architects, then you're going to love Entrepreneur Architect Academy. Entrepreneur Architect Academy is a multi-session online education program designed and built for sole proprietors, small firm architects, and architecture students. We're going to get deep into how to launch and run a successful architecture firm, how to integrate your firm with your family, and how to profitably pursue your passion for architecture. Entrepreneur Architect Academy is taking some time to produce. Sorry about that, but it's coming soon. So if you're interested, sign up for the pre-launch list at entrearchitect.com/courses. Space will be limited, and that list will receive first notice when the Academy is finally launched. There will also be super secret discounted early bird pre-launch pricing offered to members on that list, so go sign up today. entrearchitect.com/courses. Don't miss out. I think this program may just change your life. So that's a wrap for episode 18. Tune in again next week for the Entrepreneur Architect Podcast. Until then, my name is Mark R. LePage, and I am an entrepreneur architect. Thanks for listening.